What is the meaning of the Passover? Well, the Lord, apparently, the Holy Spirit, is the one that selected this term to describe an annual feast to celebrate, to commemorate this great deliverance of God's people from Egyptian bondage. But imagine, as a mental exercise this afternoon, if it were up to us to pick a word to describe this great celebration that should take place yearly and commemorate this great deliverance of God of His people from Egypt, what word might we choose? And so we're going to act as if we're kind of Moses' marketing team here and just brainstorm, what, that's two different things, some ideas about what words we might suggest. So you think about all that's tied up in the Exodus story, and you got to just pick one word. Can you think of a good word that might fit that? Nothing happened in the Exodus. Salvation. Okay, that's a great one. So, could we have an annual feast and we'll just call it salvation? Let's celebrate salvation. And of course, there's a lot of synonyms of salvation, like redemption or forgiveness. So a lot of words we could put in that category. What's another outstanding feature? Freedom. That would be a great one. Let's celebrate freedom or independence. Let's have an Independence Day celebration. That ought to resonate with us. Deliverance. Yeah, we could kind of maybe make that another kind of form of salvation. Covenant. Okay. So a covenant's a contract or an agreement. That would be a little more after the fact, but that's where ultimately it's kind of leading to. Anything else? Jonathan? Victory. All right. Or we could choose the opposite, defeat. We'll focus on the defeat of the enemy. What else does the Exodus?
Life as opposed to death.
Okay, life. And again, we could also do the opposite, death.
Redemption,
okay, that'd be another good word kind of put in that category. And that's probably the word that's used most often in the Old Testament of the Exodus story, of course. Red salvation, I know that's what it says.
Red Sea.
Red Sea, there you go. Power, okay, that was another one that had occurred to me earlier. You know, it displays the power of God. Well, we could probably go on, well, for another 30 seconds, coming up with words to describe this event, and yet God chooses this one. So it must be significant as to how this one word will kind of embody or characterize what is going on in the Exodus story. Well, why then do we call it the Passover? Well, this is one of those lessons where the preacher gets up and says, well, this word may not mean what you think it means. The traditional interpretation has certainly been the idea of God passing over God or the destroying angel sees the blood that's been administered to the doorposts of the house and will pass over that house, just bypass that house. No death of the firstborn will afflict that house because the Lord passes over. And so this would be a commemoration of the passing over. And even then, it's kind of interesting the way words are. We use those same two English words, pass and over, but we combined them in reverse and said overpass. That means something entirely different to us. Now, this is funny how language is. To oversee something and overlook something are two completely different things, but you'd think they shouldn't be. So there's all kinds of fascinating things about language, but is it possible that this doesn't really have much to do with passing over? Now, the word Passover is an English word was coined by Wycliffe, apparently, very first English translation that comes out. He used that term. Interestingly, although he, of course, was a Catholic and was making a Catholic translation of the Catholic Bible, the Vulgate, a little later, the Douay-Rheims version uses the word phase. So every time you run across Passover, it says phase. And you kind of, what do they, you know, think that meant? And there certainly is a whole traditional Jewish understanding of this passing over. And that would explain why many of the early translators kind of went that direction. But is it possible that it means something else? Well, the verb itself is only used 7 times in the Old Testament. And one of the places where that occurs is 1 Kings chapter 18 and verse 21. And this is the great contest of Elijah with the prophets of Baal. Elijah came near to all the people and said, "How long will you hesitate between two opinions?" Or limp between two opinions, I think is what the King James Version says. "If Yahweh is God, follow him. But if Baal is God, follow him." But the people did not answer him a word. Well, it's this idea of being lame and limping along. It's the same word that is used that is translated supposedly as passing over in Exodus chapter 12. The word occurs again in verse 26. They took the ox which was given them, they prepared it, called on the name of Baal from morning till noon, saying, "O Baal, answer us." But there was no voice, and no one answered. And they leaped about the altar which they had made. And then some interpret this as some kind of frantic cultic dance, or they're jumping around or something like that. But here, 2 of the 7 occurrences in the same place here in 1 Kings chapter 18. The third occurrence is in 2 Samuel chapter 4 and verse 4, another passage you're probably quite familiar with. You may remember Jonathan had a son, and his name was Mephibosheth. And in the hurry to flee, of course, he is dropped, and he became lame. And so it's the same word of, you know, limping, hobbling along, something like that. This is what happened to him. And so you've got that, which raises a question of etymology or linguistics. You know, what does this word actually mean? We have very little to go on. Well, here are 3 passages that clue us in that doesn't seem to have anything to do with passing over anything as much as being lame or limping, something like that. Another passage to consider, and the only other place it occurs outside of Exodus chapter 12, is Isaiah chapter 31 and verse 5. So Isaiah chapter 31 and verse 5. "Like flying birds, so Yahweh of hosts will protect Jerusalem. He will protect and deliver it. He will," and the New American Standard says, "pass over," that's the word we're looking at here, "and rescue it." So the picture might be of a bird flying over, and as he's flying over, he decides to engage in some kind of rescue operation of the city of Jerusalem. But that's assuming what is to be proven. What does this word actually mean? All of the other terms that are used in this verse refer to protecting God's people in some way. It has nothing to do with passing over anything. And it has been suggested that, in fact, this word has the idea of protection to it. That's the sense in which Isaiah is using it here. In fact, the Greek translation that is made of Isaiah 31:5 uses the word rescue as its translation for this Passover word that occurs in this verse. And, in fact, if we go back to Exodus chapter 12, which is where the word is going to occur, you know, a couple more times. Here, the Greek translators, again in verse 13 and again in verse 27, they choose a word that means to protect or to cover something up like a tent, provide some kind of protection. And that at least opens the door that may be part of the idea of what is involved in this kind of word. And in fact, we're not going to get it all into Hebrew lexicography here. I mean, that's the last thing anyone wants to go to church. Oh, we're going to sermons on Hebrew lexicography. That's great. And you can find all kinds of ideas out there, but just to summarize or simplify, the prevailing view among the scholars who study these kind of things is that it is preferable to find a meaning for this word that can explain all of the usages that we find in the Old Testament, as opposed to saying, well, it's spelled the same, but it's a completely different word, and it means the limp. And then we got this other word that's being used in Exodus 12. Yes, it's spelled the same, but it's a completely different word, and it means to pass over. Is it possible to find a meaning that's common to all of them? And so the suggestion has been made, perhaps the idea is some kind of force that is being applied. So pushing against or striking against or hitting against something. And what that opens up is the possibility that there are kind of two directions in which this force, of course, might go. If you're the agent or the actor who is throwing out some kind of force, it is targeted at somebody. And so you're engaging in this action, this striking. But then from the victim's perspective, he wants to shield himself. He wants to resist. And there is some kind of pushing back or hitting back or striking back to repel the force or the blow that is being administered. And this is what brings us to the other little, you know, subtitle, Hebrew Lexicography and Newtonian Physics. Do you remember Newton's third law of physics? To every action, there is an equal and opposite reaction. And that is what is being suggested by these Hebrew scholars about this particular word. And that would explain why, when you drop a kid, which is not a good thing to do, there is going to be a degree of force that is applied to that child. That force is going to be countered, and then lameness can result. And that would account for why there is some limping or lameness that is associated with this term. And the suggestion is made, that's really what's going on with this term when we come to the Exodus. So, again, getting away from Hebrew lexicography, let's turn our attention to the text and what the text actually says. The first thing you have to recognize as significant is that Yahweh, the Lord God of Israel, is the one who strikes the Egyptians and the Israelites. It isn't some rogue demonic force that is out there that's out of control that God has to rein in, some kind of evil, powerful force that's out there that God kind of lassos to do his bidding for him. This is God himself that is striking all people. And that point is made repeatedly here in Exodus chapter 12, of course. Notice in verse 12, I will go through the land of Egypt on that night and will strike down all the firstborn in the land of Egypt, both man and beast, and against all the gods of Egypt, I will execute judgments. I am Yahweh. This is clearly the doing of God. The blood shall be a sign for you on the houses where you live, and when I see the blood, I will do something. Again, I don't want to prejudice our thinking here, the Passover, that's probably what your version says, but if we at least open our minds to the possibility, that's not exactly what this word means, that if it means something like, I'm going to apply some kind of resisting force, no plague will befall you to destroy you when I strike the land of Egypt. And if you come on down to verse 23, for Yahweh will pass through to smite the Egyptians, and when he sees the blood on the lintel on the two doorposts, Yahweh will, again, do something to that door, and will not allow the destroyer to come into your houses to smite you. Well, now there's this destroyer, this destroying force that appears. Well, it's very clear it's still Yahweh, but it's this aspect of Yahweh that's manifest as a destroying force, right? And that destroying force is not going to be permitted to enter into the house. It's forbidden. And then verse 27, you will say, it is a Passover sacrifice to Yahweh who passed over or did something to the houses of the sons of Israel when he smote the Egyptians but spared our homes. And the people bowed low and worshiped. So again, it's pretty clear that Yahweh is the one that's doing this. But what I would like to draw your attention to is the fact that we're not talking about something that's merely a passive quality that All that happened in the Exodus is, well, when it came to the Egyptians, God was doing a lot of smiting. But when it came to those who had plied the door, God just failed to smite or opted not to smite. He just passed over. And that's a more of a passive action, obviously. It's not like he just had to refrain from doing something in order to pass over their houses. But if these Hebrew scholars are correct, then it would explain what is being emphasized in the text here in verse 23 again, that the destroyer is not permitted to enter into the houses to smite the people. That suggests some more active quality of God, that he's actually done something that makes it impossible for the destroying force to enter into the houses and to doom the people. And in verse 27, this passing over that takes place is again equated with the smiting of the Egyptians, but also the delivering, the rescuing of his own people. That again is a more active quality or aspect about what God is doing. Now finally, what I would suggest we think about is another context that helps us to understand what's going on here. It's not just your linguistic context, your literary context, but ultimately the theological context of the whole Bible, but especially as we see the reality of this fulfilled in the New Testament. Because if all the story of the Exodus was a story of God physically rescuing some people from Egyptian slavery, that it might just be possible that we could think of it in terms of God come along and, okay, I'm going to skip this house because, you know, they got blood on the door, and I'm going to go to the next house and smite them. But we understand that the Exodus story is itself a model pointing to the greater spirituality, which is that we are all guilty of sin. And a couple of questions I would ask you to think about. First of all, is there any circumstance in which our appeal to God would be, Lord, pass us by. Just pass over me. That's all I want. Now, we can certainly imagine situations which we feel so desperate about our sin and our unworthiness that we would be like Peter, you know, in Luke chapter 5, Lord, depart from me. I'm a sinful man. But I suspect if you had been able to interview Peter and said, now, do you really mean you never want to see Jesus again or have any interaction with him and you don't want him to be your friend anymore? Well, if that's really how Peter felt, he could have easily just hightailed it the other direction and that'd been the end of it. And so, yeah, we might feel at times, I want the Lord to pass over me because of my sin. But if then someone says, do you really not want the Lord to be with you anymore? You know, if it's a package deal, Lord passes by your sin, but he's out of your life, he's not there with you. Absolutely not. In fact, the two songs that we have sung just before the lesson, be with me, Lord, that's our constant prayer. We even have a song in the songbook, do not pass me by, right? That's really how we feel. And so would we think that this Lord passing over us would be a good thing? If he's just entirely passing us by? You know, it kind of reminds me of that scene from Jurassic Park where the T-Rex breaks out and, you know, the paleontologist says, don't move. He can't see if you don't move. He goes, vision's based on motion, you know, and kind of feel like God sometimes that way. If I just, you know, if we don't move, if we don't say anything, God won't see us, you know. He'll just pass by. That's a terrible way to conceive of our relationship with God, and I don't think that's what is intended here in the Exodus story. More importantly, the second question I'd want us to think about, if we understand that the Exodus story is really about our own sin, is there ever really a time in which God passes over sin? God just, I'll just turn a blind eye, you know. I'll just ignore that. That doesn't seem to fit with what the rest of the Bible teaches us about what God does in regard to our sin. And so I would suggest that the reality better conforms to what these Hebrew scholars are telling us, which is this. If, in fact, all are guilty of sin, and the Exodus story can educate us to some extent about what really goes on in the spiritual realm, And what we need to understand is that the smiting of God is against all people. There is a smiting that is due the Egyptians. There is a smiting that is due the Israelites. The heavy hammer of God's justice must smite those who are in sin. And that's the plight of everybody. And no house will be able to escape. But what God says is, even though that smiting is due and it must be done, God Himself will stand in front of the blow and He will take it Himself. And that's the message we see over and over again throughout the Bible. And so what is being suggested by these Hebrew scholars is that this word Passover doesn't mean Passover, it means pushback. In other words, that when the destroying angel comes to smite this house, that God stands at the door and God allows Himself to be smitten. And the blow is repelled. There is an equal and sufficient force to negate that blow. And so the house is unscathed, the house is delivered. But you see, that calls for a much more active role on the part of God. It isn't just, oh, God's going to skip over this house. But God will actually step in and say, I will bear the blow of my own justice. And of course, that's what Isaiah 53 is about. The blows that are due us are taken upon God Himself. And of course, Isaiah chapter 53 is echoed quite a bit in 1 Peter chapter 2. 1 Peter chapter 2, of course, this is the passage in verse 21 where Peter says, you know, this is the very thing we've been called to walk in the footsteps of Jesus, follow His example, which is suffering. He committed no sin, no deceit was found in His mouth. While being reviled, He didn't revile back. The key is, He kept entrusting Himself to Him who judges righteously. And notice verse 24, He Himself bore our sins in His body on the cross that we might die to sin and live to righteousness. For by His wounds you were healed. And that's what I'm suggesting is being represented here, is that this great blasting, smiting force of God that was manifest on that terrible night in Egypt, well, God was willing to bear that blow and to negate that blow in the case of those who would apply the blood. And that's certainly what happens in the case of our sin. But perhaps this is a case where, after all, Newton's third law of physics fails. That it is not that to every action there is an equal and opposite reaction, but in the spiritual realm there are certain actions that are met with an even greater and opposite effect, and that the great justice of God is more than met by the loving forgiveness and mercy of God. Because the force isn't just one that is up to the task of negating the blow of God's justice, but also of doing something far greater. In fact, if we keep reading in 1 Peter chapter 3, we find out in verse 18, Christ also died for sins once for all, the one who was just for the many who were unjust, so that He might bring us to God, having been put to death in the flesh. That's that smiting of God. But He is made alive in the Spirit. In which Spirit? He went and made proclamation to the spirits in their refuge. Again, I don't think it was an actual sermon that He preached or a message, but just when the word went out in the spirit realm that Christ is victorious, the evil spirit powers that be knew that they were doomed. It's just like Paul says in Colossians chapter 2 and verse 15, that Christ stripped them and He made a public spectacle of them. And so He has been exalted over all. He's been given the name that is above every name. And so that is what Christ has done in the realm of our sin. And so it's no wonder then, when we get to 1 Corinthians chapter 5, that Paul here refers to Christ as our Passover. He says in verse 6, 1 Corinthians chapter 5, verse 6, your boasting is not good. Do you not know a little leaven leavens the whole lump of dough? Clean out the old leaven so that you may be a new lump, just as you are in fact unleavened. And of course this yeast or leaven is a great picture of our sin. For Christ, our Passover also has been sacrificed. And therefore, let us celebrate the feast, not with old leaven, or with the leaven of malice and wickedness, but with the unleavened bread of sincerity and truth. And it's clear that Christ is represented as the true Passover for us. It's no accident that the Lord's Supper is instituted on the night of the Passover. And there are other passages, like John the Baptist's testimony that, "Behold, the Lamb of God who takes away the sin of the world." Or 1 Peter, again, chapter 1 and verse 18, "We've not been redeemed by perishable things like silver and gold, worthless things like that, but by this precious, unblemished blood, the blood of Christ." Perhaps our Bibles ought to say, "Christ, our pushback, has been sacrificed. Christ, that divine force that answers to the justice of God and bears the blow on our behalf, he is the one that has been sacrificed for us." And so I just invite you to think about that, and whether the Hebrew scholars are right about the meaning of this Hebrew word. I certainly think theologically it is true that this passing over of the Israelites during the Exodus is not a passive quality of God, but the active defense of his people, the active protection of his people. And that makes sense in that passage in Isaiah 31 again. And that Jerusalem that God is protecting in that passage, of course, ultimately is us, those of us who make up God's people today. And so we take great comfort in knowing God's not just passively doing anything, but he is actively protecting us and bearing the blows that are due us. And so let's think about this as we partake of the Lord's Supper this morning.